this is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the July 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday. I want to open the phones to you, our listeners, as was the case last month during our summer fund drive. On behalf of Joy DeClaire, I'm host of Forthright Radio, which is heard here on first and third Wednesdays. I want to thank all of you who showed your support for the kind of programming that she and I have been bringing you every week at this time. And today will be no different. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with former CIA field officer Phil Giraldi about the significance of the recent NATO military exercises in Poland near the Russian border that took place last month, and about the U.S. attitude toward Russia itself. They were the largest such exercises since the end of the Cold War and part of the efforts by President Obama and the U.S. military to energize NATO to prepare for what he and like minds in Washington view as a threat of Russian aggression. Their opinion does not seem to be shared by NATO's major European partners, as typified by German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who referred to the military exercises as saber-rattling. Thus far, at least publicly, none of the pundits in the mainstream U.S. media have pointed out the irony of Nobel Prize winner Obama of having gone to Europe to pressure Washington's NATO allies to spend more of their budgets on weapons of war and provide troops for a possible confrontation with Russia while America was exploding with violence. With the case of Micah Johnson, the black veteran who had served in Afghanistan and what back in 2008 candidate Obama had labeled the right war, and who Saturday gunned down five Dallas policemen, the link was unmistakable. That incident brought to mind the comment by Malcolm X in 1963 following the assassination of President John Kennedy that, quote, the chickens have come home to roost. This time, that comment fits. One of Obama's goals in Poland was to get a fourth NATO member to join the U.S., Britain, and Germany in providing a battalion of troops to patrol the borders of former members of the now disbanded Soviet Union in Eastern Europe to halt any act of Russian aggression, the chances of which appear greater the further one is from the potential field of combat. No other European country, however, volunteered to provide the troops. Instead, they expressed more interest in a rapprochement and renewing trade with Russia than continuing sanctions and confrontation. It was left to Washington's new poodle dog, Canada's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, to step up and say that his country would do it. As I mentioned in my last program, the Europeans who have experienced war on their soil appear to be no more worried about the threat of the Russian invasion than the generation of Europeans who faced the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Even more so now than then, there has not been a single national politician of either party who has had the wisdom or the courage to challenge the administration's narrative about any aspect of U.S. foreign policy, apart from the neocons, many of whom are supporting Hillary Clinton, who believe, like Clinton, that it should be more aggressive. For something entirely different and refreshing on that score, I'm going to play for you a short critique of the West interventionist policies made on the floor of the European Parliament in March of 2015 by Nigel Farage, a right-wing member of Britain's Independence Party, who a year later would become a most vocal proponent for Brexit, and after having won that fight, he promptly resigned from politics. But here is Nigel Farage, a little over a year ago, making a statement and then responding to a question from a member of the Romanian delegation, Nigel Farage.
I'd be wondering why David Cameron's been slashing our armed forces, won't commit to 2%, is happy for us not to be able to defend our islands. I think Mr. Juncker's given us the answer. We're going to do it at an EU level. We're going to have a European army. Now, when I raised this last year with the Deputy Prime Minister, Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg, he said it was a dangerous fantasy to even talk about an EU army. I hope every Liberal Democrat voter has heard Mr. Verhofstadt today, the leader of the European Liberals, crying out for militarisation at an EU level. Of course, the truth is, it's already happening. We already have a European Defence Agency. We already have EU battle groups on active service all over the world. We already have an EU Navy active against the Somali pirates, and who can forget Eurocorps here in Strasbourg last year, virtually goose-stepping that ghastly flag round the courtyard outside. And of course, the Lisbon Treaty, Article 28, provides for all of this. Tony Blair was right. He said the European Union is not a project about peace, it's a project about power. And I think Mr. Juncker is trying to seize on an opportunity. We ourselves in the European Union provoked the conflict through our territorial expansionism in the Ukraine. We poked the Russian bear with a stick, and unsurprisingly, Putin reacted. But this now is to be used as an opportunity to build a European army. And when Mr. Mr. Verhofstadt, I know that by heckling, you increase your hits on YouTube, because otherwise nobody in Europe wants to listen to you. And the president really ought to let me speak.
Just a moment, please. Just a moment.
Thank you.
Mr. Farage, just a moment, please. Just a moment. Mr. Verhofstadt, I turn to you. I have to ask you, please, to calm down. You may not like this speech, but we are Democrats and we listen to you too. So please do not interrupt.
Well, we certainly are Democrats, and we've never shouted you down, but you always try and shout us down. The point I was making is this. The opportunity is being seized, and Mr. Juncker said we must convey to Russia that we are serious. Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Juncker? We do not want any part of an EU army, and I doubt the rest of the peoples of Europe do either. Thank you.
Well, it's a bit of fun.
Mr. Sulich, I believe you had a question. Is that right? Mr. Farage, I take it? Is that right?
In fact, I would like to ask Mr. Farage, what do you think that we should have to do, Mr. Farage, when Russia, for example, is supporting with the most modern armaments, you know, the separatists? Do you, as an European Union, have to do something to support Ukraine, to fight in the eastern Ukraine, or do you think that we should have to wait to fight on the western Ukraine for the stability of Europe? Don't you think that we together, we have to send a clear message of solidarity and unity of the European Union considering this important subject? Thank you.
We, through our territorial ambitions, provoke the overthrow of an albeit corrupt but democratically elected leader in the Ukraine. We have provoked this crisis. Now, the question you ask is, what do we do from here? I was in this chamber at the time when Libya was attacked. I heard the Liberals and the Greens screaming, frothing at the mouth, for us to bomb Libya, for us to become militarily involved, because we believed that would make things better. My view, sir, is if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at Iraq, if you look at Libya, and you look at the attempt to back the rebels in Syria, many of whom have now morphed into ISIS, we see that our recent foreign military interventions have made things worse, not better.
And that was Nigel Farage of the British Independence Party. Now, can you imagine any elected American official saying what you have just heard? No, I didn't think so. Well, amidst the fallout from the Brexit vote in Britain last week, the government released the long-awaited Chilcot Report, which provides a detailed investigation into Prime Minister Tony Blair's decision to join the United States in invading Iraq and deposing Saddam Hussein. What the report concluded was what had already become general knowledge, that the evidence that Saddam either had or was in the process of assembling weapons of mass destruction was patently false, and that Blair had been warned by aides about the perils of such an adventure. The Chilcot Inquiry, named after Sir John Chilcot, a senior civil servant who headed the investigation, was the fourth conducted in Britain on the Iraq War. The first, in 2003, focused on intelligence failures. The second, called the Hutton Inquiry, investigated the strange circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, a scientist and member of the UN weapons inspection team who is alleged to have committed suicide. And a third, in 2004, focused once again on failures by the intelligence services. The Chilcot, the most exhaustive of the four, was initiated by Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, in 2009. The report, released last Wednesday, comprises 12 volumes, reviews 150,000 documents, examines more than 150 witnesses, none of whom were Iraqi, by the way, and cost almost £10 million. It was supposed to be finished in 2 years, but was delayed by 2010 elections and disputes as to whether certain sensitive communications between Bush and Blair should be published, and finally by the Brexit referendum. Curiously, days before the scheduled release of the report, prosecutors at the International Criminal Court in The Hague ruled out bringing Blair to trial, but nevertheless kept open the option of bringing British soldiers to justice for possible war crimes in Iraq. Scottish leaders, however, have indicated they will explore possibilities of bringing Blair to justice in Scotland. One might think that all this activity in Britain about a war that was planned by Washington would stir Americans to call for the launching of at least one investigation of the elected officials who were ultimately responsible for launching that war, beginning with but not limited to George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, and Condoleezza Rice. But the president that arguably was elected to do so, Barack Obama, in one of his first acts in office, effectively pardoned those war criminals by declaring that the time had come for the country to look forward, not backward. The Democrats, who had gained control of Congress on the basis of the newly found criticism, went along with him, led by the new House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the American public not only let them all get away with it, they have watched in relative indifference as Obama has gone on to become, with his assassinations by drone, the leading propagator of state terror. Recent research by the human rights organization Reprieve, which assists the civilian victims of drone strikes, has found that the U.S. is frequently unable to identify those killed by covert strikes in countries including Pakistan and Yemen. Reprieve has found that, in targeting 41 named individuals, U.S. strikes killed 1,147 unknown men, women, and children, often leaving the original target still alive. Quote, "It's been 3 years since President Obama promised long-overdue transparency over the most dangerous legacy of his presidency," said Jennifer Gibson, a Reprieve staff attorney. "A drone program that has reportedly killed thousands in countries where the U.S. is not at war. In that time," she said, "we have been inundated with repeated and contradictory claims about the program from anonymous sources who cannot be held accountable for their claims." Speaking on June 18th, Gibson pointed out, quote, "The administration's spin machine was once again in action, first leaking that the government's numbers would not include Pakistan, a country that accounts for 3/4 of all strikes, and then absurdly walking back that position. Enough panic legacy spinning," said Gibson. "The administration must reveal the true scale of the civilian deaths it has caused and at the very least offer an apology to the victims," end quote. Well, to begin with, the White House needs to acknowledge them. A report on drone activity earlier this month insulted the public's intelligence by claiming that the total number of civilians killed by U.S. drone strikes numbered between 64 and 116. What Americans seem to be more interested in, however, is getting their own private drones. One of the more disappointing but frankly predictable occurrences during the Democratic Party platform committee meeting was when Barbara Lee, the darling of many Berkeley liberals, cast a deciding vote against a platform plank opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement and any statements acknowledging Israel's occupation of opposing Israel's settlements. Upon finding this information online, I called Lee's Oakland office to register my complaint, one of some 150 similar calls that had come into her office since the previous day, her staff member told me. He also said that Lee actually opposes TPP and Israeli occupation and settlements, as did he himself, but that for political reasons she had to vote the way she did and that she would explain why in a message on her website. There was no message on her website. Finally, there's something very important going on between Russia's Vladimir Putin and Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, which appears to date from Israel's decision not to back U.S.-sponsored sanctions against Russia for its annexation of Crimea in 2014, a significant act that was also significantly ignored by the U.S. media, as is this story. This past June 7th, Netanyahu made his fourth state visit to Moscow in the space of a year, during which the affinity between the Israeli prime minister and the Russian president was on full public display. Professor Giancarlo Elia Valori, a well-known European economist, wrote about the meeting and its importance in the June 29th online and English edition of Israel Defense. Quote, "During the meeting, the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to start military cooperation between the two countries. It is an historic decision," notes Valori, "which breaks the traditional link existing between the Israeli and U.S. forces. A change of strategic perspective by both countries, which significantly modifies the old traditional postures inherited from the Cold War." It marks the end of the Russian univocal support to the Arab countries inherited from the Soviet Union to strengthen the, quote, the national middle classes of the Islamic world. According to Valori, it also marks the end of the unique relationship between Israel and the United States, designed to oppose the USSR allies in the Middle East. On the one hand, he points out, the relationship with the United States strengthened Israel at technological level, but on the other hand, it forced it into a strategic horizon typical of a small regional power, which is currently no longer reasonable. The meeting held on June 7th was also attended by the head of the IDF Military Intelligence Directorate, Major General Herzl Halevi, and the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen. Moreover, next, writes Professor Valori, joint Russian-Israeli naval and air operations will take place with Russian aircraft and ships coming from the Syrian bases. An economic and energy factor must also be considered, he says. The Russian companies can participate in the development and exploitation of the Israeli Tamar and Leviathan gas fields offshore. There is also a strategic factor to be considered. The Russian presence will prevent the fields and pipelines from becoming the targets of attacks by Iran, the Hezbollah, and Syria. Obviously, Valori goes on, the naval and air cooperation is such as to protect both Israel and Russia from an inadvertent mix of military intelligence. At an operational level, the mechanism for exchanging information between Russia and Israel during the aerial warfare in Syria will be further strengthened and expanded. The strategic links at naval level will be established at a later stage. Currently, notes Valori, President Putin's primary interest is to strengthen the ties between Israel and Turkey, while for Prime Minister Netanyahu, Russia could be an optimal power broker to negotiate and finally achieve stable and lasting peace between the Jewish state and the Palestinian universe. Well, I don't know about that. Anyway, furthermore, Russia did not lift a finger when the Israeli Air Force attacked the convoys which went to supply the Shia militias in the Syrian war. The foregoing was part of an important article by Professor Giancarlo Elia Valori, a well-known European economist, which can be found in the June 29th online English edition of Israel Defense, which focuses on Israeli security issues. Yet the U.S. media has chosen not to report on any of this as predictable, given that it has a vested interest in condemning Putin and supporting Netanyahu. How would their readers understand it? Since Putin is the latest bogeyman in Washington's crosshairs and Netanyahu is the darling of many members of Congress from both parties, the very idea that America's great Middle East ally is in bed with its latest, greatest antagonist, as Putin is universally presented in the media and by the political class, with ironically the exception of Donald Trump, it might be enough to get Americans wondering about the value of Israel as an ally, even as it demands $40 billion plus dollars from Uncle Sam over the next decade. I was talking about this situation that has not been reported between the Israelis and the Russians, but I'm going to read to you from Phil Giraldi's article today. It appeared on the American Conservative. He says, Phil Giraldi, former CIA analyst, whenever the subject of American foreign policy catastrophes comes up, the word Iraq immediately comes to mind. But George W. Bush's ill-fated invasion of that hapless land in reality did not do irreparable damage to the United States. That is not to trivialize the cost, including trillions of dollars and the deaths of thousands of Americans plus hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. But the reality is that the U.S. homeland was not attacked, and the economy has not collapsed, making Iraq a war that should never have been fought, but not a defeat in historic terms. One thinks of Russia less frequently when U.S. policy failures are examined. In 1991, Russia was a superpower. Today, it is a convenience, a straw man for fortuitously produced whenever someone in power wants to justify weapons expenditures or the initiation of a new military interventions to faraway places. Much of the negative interaction between Washington and Moscow is driven by the consensus among policymakers, the Western media, and the inside the Beltway crowd that Russia is again or perhaps is still and always will be the enemy du jour. but frequently forgotten or ignored is the fact that Moscow, even in its much reduced state, continues to control the only military resource on the planet that can destroy the United States, suggesting caution should be in order when one goes about goading the bear. Truly, the unwillingness to take steps after 1991 to assist Russia in its post-communism transformation into a stable, prosperous, and secure state modeled on the West is the most significant foreign policy failure by both Democratic and Republican administrations in the past 30 years. The spoliation of Russia's natural resources carried out by Western carpetbaggers working with local grifters turned oligarchs under Boris Yeltsin, the expansion of NATO to Russia's doorstep initiated by Bill Clinton, and the interference in Russia's internal affairs by the U.S. government, including the Magnitsky Act, have exploited Russian vulnerability and have produced a series of governments in Moscow that have become increasingly paranoid and disinclined to cooperate with what they see as a threatening Washington. There have also been unnecessary slights and insults along the way, including sanctions on Russian officials and a refusal to attend the Sochi Olympics, to cite only two examples. The drive by Washington democracy promoters and global hegemonists working together to push Ukraine into the Western economic and political sphere was a major miscalculation, as they failed to realize or did not care that what takes place in Kiev is to Moscow a vital interest. Heedless of that reality, the Obama administration, which recently endorsed the somewhat bizarre entry of Montenegro into the NATO alliance, is already treating Georgia and Ukraine as if they were de facto members. Hillary Clinton, who has likened Vladimir Putin to Adolf Hitler, has pledged to bring about their full membership in the alliance. It would not in any way make Americans more secure, quite the contrary, as the United States is pledging itself under the NATO Article 5 to defend both countries. Moscow, for its part, would be forced to react to such expansion. Nearly everything Russia does is considered wrong or even threatening by the White House, Congress, and the U.S. media. I was reminded of that, writes Philip Giraldi. I was reminded of that predilection when I read recent accounts of Russian quote-unquote harassment of American diplomats overseas. The story described how, in one instance, a U.S. embassy officer returning to the building late one night was challenged by a Russian guard and a scuffle ensued. In other alleged incidents, the apartments of employees were searched, and it was even claimed that a pet dog had been killed. Certainly, the incidents are deplorable, but they are not exactly unusual in the world where spies and spy catchers interact. The old KGB was, and its successor organization, the FSB, still is, adept at tricks to unnerve suspected intelligence officers and render them less effective, forcing them always to be looking out for surveillance even when it was not there. From my time in the CIA training in the late 70s, writes Phil Giraldi, I recall descriptions of how an agency officer had parked his car on a Moscow street only to return to find it gone. It turned up in a plowed field 100 miles away a few days later with no tire tracks evident. It had been picked up and moved by helicopter. Or an officer would return to his apartment and find all his books arranged in alphabetical order or dinner prepared and sitting on the table. The FBI would do the same sort of thing to suspected KGB or GRU officers in the United States, writes Giraldi, a warning that they were being observed and that the Bureau knew what they were up to. In the intelligence world, it is business as usual, but in the U.S. media, the latest round of spy versus spy was depicted as another sign of barbaric behavior on the part of the Russians. The point here, writes Phil Giraldi, is the Russians are not exactly failing to notice what is going on and are drawing their own conclusions about what they must do to defend themselves. None but Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the Kagan family actually want a war. But Moscow is being backed into a corner with more and more... I've just got lost my... it's been backed into a war. And the point here is Russia is not exactly failing to notice what's going on and are drawing their own conclusions about what they must do to defend themselves. None but Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the Kagan family, which I already read, want a war, but Moscow is being backed into a corner with more and more influential Russian voices raised against détente with Washington. It seems to be intent on humiliating Moscow at every turn as part of a new project for regime change. Many Russian military leaders have come to believe that the continuous NATO expansion means that the United States wants war, and both the generals and Vladimir Putin are warning that a resort to arms could easily go nuclear, as Moscow will use all weapons available to defend itself. Putin is incidentally the voice for moderation as he still aspires to a positive relationship with the West, a position he reiterated in his July 4th message to President Obama. Russia's generals are not optimistic about what's coming their way. They are insecure because they are aware of their own military inferiority and see nothing but hostility from the West, including evidence that American generals have collaborated to fabricate Russian threats in Europe to force a U.S. reaction. The Russians, write Phil Giraldi, understand that the buildup of forces on both sides of the border that has resulted from the clashing interests is unstable and dangerously unpredictable. The Russian military justifies its responses based on what it has clearly and unambiguously observed and what it is hearing. But when the Western powers probe Russian borders with their warships and surveillance aircraft, they claim it is aggression when Moscow scrambles a plane to monitor the activity. NATO has now decided to base four multinational battalions of combat soldiers in Eastern Europe along the Russian border, the first troop deployment aimed at Moscow since the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1991. Washington, in its own prepackaged view, described itself as behaving defensively from purest of motives, while Moscow was always in the wrong. But Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov notes that it's, quote, it is not his country that's moving soldiers up to a border to confront the West. Picture for a moment a reverse scenario, with a Russian missile cruiser lounging just outside the territorial waters off Boston or New York, or a Marine infantry brigade based in Cuba, and imagine Congress and the U.S. media. I was reminded of that predilection when what the U.S. reaction might be. Washington's misguided policy toward Russia under both Republican and Democratic presidents has the potential to become the greatest international catastrophe of all time, with a risk of ending human life on the planet as we know it. NATO expansionism and the regular promotion of false narratives that Russia is seeking to recreate the Soviet Union together suggest to that country's leaders that Washington is an implacable foe. The bellicose posturing inadvertently strengthens the hands of hardline nationalists in Russia while weakening those who seek a formula for accommodation with the West. Only the much maligned Donald Trump sees the situation with some clarity. Speaking in Moscow last week, his foreign policy advisor Carter Page stated in the words of ABC News that, quote, the U.S. had been overtly hostile toward Russia and the blame for the current tensions lay largely with the American government, end quote. He echoed Trump's own attacks on Washington's foreign policy consensus, suggesting that the U.S. experts and officials' assessment of Russia was skewed by an anti-Russian bias and that they are often unnecessarily perpetuated Cold War tendencies, end quote. To be sure, Russia is no innocent in the international one-upsmanship game, writes Phil Giraldi, but the nearly constant animosity directed against Russia by the Obama administration and likely to continue under President Clinton should be seen as madness, as the stakes in the game, a possible nuclear war, are unthinkable. That's from Phil Giraldi in today's American Conservative. And I would add that we read in the papers constant references to the Russian invasion of Crimea, when in fact Russian soldiers were already stationed in Crimea with an agreement with the Ukrainian government. We talk about Russian aggression, and that has become like a given. It's become like a mantra of the mainstream media. What is interesting, and I hope to talk to Phil Giraldi about, was this relationship that has developed between Israel and Russia. Putin obviously is a chess player, and chess is the national game of Russia. And what he is doing and what he sees is doing what is obviously he considers to be best for Russia. And while you have all these neocons here who have this deep hatred for communism and Russia and the Soviet Union that even surpasses or at least equals their love for Israel, Israel's foreign policy is not based on what the U.S. neocons want. In fact, the Israelis pretty much look at American Jews, even their supporters, with contempt. They call them maybe checkbook Zionists. But they have their own foreign policy, and there are more than a million Israelis are from Russia, and they have very strong ties with their homeland. And recently, they are now, those Jews who left Russia under the Soviet Union are now going to get pensions from Russia, which they weren't receiving before. And there's a lot of back and forth. The new defense minister of Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, who's from Moldova, when he speaks with Putin, they speak in Russian. I should mention, by the way, that in his papers yesterday and online yesterday, they're up in arms in Israel because Lieberman has appointed as the chief rabbi of the Israeli Defense Forces, a rabbi who advocated the legitimacy of Israeli soldiers raping Gentile women in a war situation because the Torah justifies that. And there's an up-in-arms criticism in Israel of Ayel Karim is his name, who was a former colonel in the Israeli military, who is now the chief rabbi appointed by Avigdor Lieberman. You won't obviously see this story in the American media either, but it's really interesting that the story about Putin going to Russia four times and the meetings taking place has not been in any U.S. media. Even the Jewish media here are not talking about it. I get the story from an Israeli intelligence online service that has a lot of interesting articles on it, again, that do not reflect anything about U.S. foreign policy, but from particularly an Israeli point of view. And so the Israelis see that they can actually make sure that this story does not get in the U.S. press, because imagine what would happen if Americans would see headlines that are pictures of Russia, Putin and Netanyahu shaking hands and giving each other hugs, or they don't do high fives over there. And then Americans learning that Russia and Israel are going to do military exercises together. And here Russia is demanding more than $40 billion of weapons for over a 10-year period from the United States, and object to the fact that President Obama wants all that money to be spent here and not a quarter of it spent in Israel, which is now one of the largest weapons vendors in the world and actually competes with the United States in selling weapons to a number of what used to be called third world countries, but also countries like India. The United States wants to sell weapons to India. Israel wants to sell them as well. And so here the United States is going to be giving billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer paid weaponry to Israel while Israel is selling its weapons to India and other countries. So this is one of the situations that is very important. It's almost as important politically as Brexit is in England. It's interesting, it hasn't been mentioned here, but it is on the online media. The new Prime Minister of Israel, of England, Theresa May, is a very strong advocate, supporter of Israel, as was Tony Blair, as was David Cameron. But there is an opposition in the British Parliament that does have the courage to speak out critical of Israel that we do not see in the U.S. Congress. I reported to you on this, the vote in the platform committee, where Barbara Lee, who was hailed for the fact that she was a lone vote in Congress to oppose the Iraq War, finds it a lot easier to do that than to take a position critical of Israel. And so here we have her appointed to the platform committee, and whereas her office says that she criticizes Israeli settlements and that she supports the opposes the TPP, which is like part of a package here, that she then votes not to even mention Israeli settlements. And also there was something going to be in the platform proposed by those members of the platform committee appointed by Bernie Sanders, that some aid be given, reparations be given, or aid be given to help rebuild Gaza. And that also, which was destroyed with U.S. weaponry, exclusively U.S. weaponry, but that also did not meet the approval of the platform committee, and which was appointed, six of whom members were appointed by Hillary Clinton's staff, or Hillary Clinton herself. So it's interesting. Hillary Clinton claims that she is now against the TPP, but yet her appointees and the Democratic National Committee appointees and the platform committee oppose taking any position against the TPP, which points out to me the likelihood that once she gets the nomination, Hillary Clinton will reverse her position on the TPP and support it, as she did NAFTA. It's interesting. Hillary Clinton is a big supporter of Netanyahu, and Netanyahu, I don't know how she's going to react or what she is thinking about, if she even knows, and she probably does. I'm sure in Washington they're well aware of Russia's meeting, Putin's meetings with Netanyahu, and they know, if I know what was read on the to you over the air this morning, which you will not find any other media in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, I've not been able to find any reference to it at all. They know it in Washington, but they probably don't know what to do about it, because, again, I mentioned that they're in no position to criticize Netanyahu from that perspective, because the last thing they want to do is see the American public turn on Israel, in a sense, accusing Israel of biting the hand that feeds them. And why? Because these very same neocons, this very same media, and the White House have created the bogeyman of Vladimir Putin. So they have actually painted themselves into a corner. This is Jeff Blankford. You're listening to Takes on the World on KZYX. Unfortunately, we had a problem with getting our guest on the phone today. Phil Giraldi, who I've been a guest many times on this program and hope to have him a guest again. I did read his article in the American Conservative. It's interesting. I played earlier for you a Nigel Farage, the British Independence Party, a right-winger. And here's this right-winger in the British government and representing European Parliament, who has the courage to tell exactly the truth about what is happening in terms of pushing, provoking Russia over Ukraine. This was a legally elected government. The media doesn't talk about it anymore, but just before the coup, Vladimir Putin offered a $15 billion no-interest loan to Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, and Yanukovych himself had promised that he would hold a new election within 4 months and to change the government. But the United States was pushing for a regime change, and why? Because NATO at that point was trying to justify its existence. You'll have to go back, if you go back to the newspapers before the Ukraine crisis, there were articles saying, what use is NATO anymore? It was formed to defend itself against, defend Europe against the Soviet Union, of which most people in Europe did not consider to be a threat. And the Soviet Union had something called the Warsaw Pact to balance off NATO. But they dissolved the Warsaw Pact, but NATO remained. But what was NATO's job? The only time, I mean, here you have all these NATO countries fighting in Afghanistan and losing soldiers, and look what's happened in Afghanistan. It's a disaster. So there was this debate, what to do about NATO, and suddenly, in my estimation and some of others, that they created the crisis in Ukraine, which, as I said, overthrew a legitimately elected government, corrupt as it was, but there are many corrupt governments. Ukraine has a history of corruption. And rather than let the people vote, they decided to have let loose the ultra-right-wing fascists in the Ukraine national movement to push for the overthrow, and Yanukovych fled before they caught up with him and what probably would have killed him. Now, I'll recall for you, as I've recalled before, Victoria Nuland Kagan, the wife of Robert Kagan, the co-founder of Project for New American Century, who was endorsing Hillary Clinton, by the way. She bragged to a Ukrainian national organization in Washington before the coup that the United States had spent $5 billion in trying to effect regime change in Ukraine. $5 billion of American taxpayers' money. Imagine how that could have been spent. Now, she was formerly Hillary Clinton's press spokesman when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And what did our breath of fresh air in the White House do, President Obama, when he came into office? He appointed her to be, after Hillary Clinton resigned, he appointed her to be Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia. So here is Obama, who came to office on the basis of his, let's say, lukewarm opposition to the Iraq War. He did play no role in opposing the Iraq War, appointing the wife of a leading neocon, Robert Kagan, to this very important State Department position. Kagan, by the way, has written that Hillary Clinton, her foreign policy program is the neocon's program, except she won't describe it in those terms. And he actually said that. He actually wrote that. And it's unfortunately interesting or sad that when Bernie Sanders made his endorsement of Hillary Clinton, there is no mention of foreign policy. As a matter of fact, foreign policy, we all know, is his weak. It was his weak card. So now we are going to get a situation in which we have a domestic, frightful domestic character named Donald Trump, whose foreign policy is less dangerous than that of Hillary Clinton. It's not much of a choice that American public is going to be given to make. It's we'll be talking about this well before the elections, but the reality is that Hillary Clinton's foreign policy program is far more aggressive than Obama's. She has called for a no-fly zone in Syria, which would confront the Russians. She is a strong supporter of NATO and the push toward Russia's borders. Remember, she was the one who pushed Obama into getting involved in overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, which was initiated first by the French and the British, but Hillary joined in, and U.S. involvement was essential in overthrowing Gaddafi. So this track record of hers, foreign policy, nobody seems to be talking about at the moment. Also, she was in Honduras just a few weeks in an international meeting there, before there was a Honduras coup, in which a democratically elected businessman who was seen as, quote, betraying his class and trying to do something for the people was overthrown by a corrupt putsch in Honduras. And Hillary's emails revealed that she wanted to do everything she possibly could to keep Zelaya, the overthrown Honduran president, from coming back into office. And Berita, Cáceres, Bernita Cáceres, the human rights activist who was murdered in Honduras not long ago, shortly before she was murdered, assassinated, Bernita Cáceres, she publicly accused Hillary Clinton of being behind and involved with the coup in her country. That was before she was killed. This hasn't come up at all in any discussions about the presidential elections, and I don't suppose it will. The email situation, if you read what the FBI Director Comey said, obviously if this was anybody else but Hillary Clinton, I guess who is too big to jail, there would be an investigation, and certainly she would be declared unfit to hold public office. But this is a different world. When you're a certain status, you seem to have Teflon, and Democrats seem to have Teflon just like some Republicans, like we talked about Mr. Ronald Reagan being the Teflon president. Well, the Clintons have Teflon, and we're going to see how well this Teflon wears between now and Election Day. You've been listening here to Takes on the World, and I have been filling in for my guest, who we've had some miscommunications here. Our phone line had a little bit of a problem, and I hope to have Phil Giraldi back. I do, if you like what I read about what he wrote about Russia, you could find it online in the American Conservative, as well as other articles by Phil Giraldi, who is one of the more astute former CIA analysts who have become, who joined something called the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Peace, along with Ray McGovern and a number of others who have spent a number of years now criticizing U.S. foreign policy and providing a perspective that you get from working from within. Now they're working from without. Phil also heads the Council for National Interest, which is an organization of foreign policy officials, former foreign policy officials and members of Congress like Pete McCloskey, who believe the United States should have a foreign policy in the Middle East that's independent of Israel's influence, which we're far from having. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.